We are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. Hey, listen, before I bring on our next guest, I got to remind you guys of something. One of our latest advertisers, Inspire Advisors. Okay, I'm going to give you something big to think about. I'm going to give you something free also. You ready for this? So, yes, this is a crazy world. You hear about it all the time on this show, and you see it in your own life. And here you are. I know this audience. Here you are. You're working hard to plan for your future, but you're also doing what you can to stand up for your beliefs. But what if you found out that some of your investments, the things you're setting aside for the future, are actually going to things that are absolutely contrary to what you say you believe in? Well, maybe it's time for you to meet Paul Breyer and his team of PhDs and financial experts at Inspire Advisors. Inspire Advisors. Look, I'm talking about financial planning, y'all, that considers who you are, what you believe in, as much as your bottom line. I mean, these are solid local experts. They use biblically responsible investing, data-driven strategies to maximize your return, and they do it in a way that has real impact on your bottom line and the world in which you live, and this is what I would call financial freedom. So here's the free thing. You ready? If you want to check out your current portfolio and see whether or not some of what you're investing in has been going to the wrong places, you can go on their website and get a free impact report. It's a free impact report from Inspire Advisors at www.moneypatternwealth.com. That's moneypatternwealth.com. You can also go, by the way, to our website, rightsideradio.org, and you can click on the sponsors tab and just go straight to their logo and click on it. You'll get to their same website. Here's the bottom line. It's conservative, it's godly, it's balanced, it's financial freedom, it's Inspire Advisors at moneypatternwealth.com. Check them out. All right, listen, our next guest is coming on to help us launch the next portion of the show here. Dipper number two, I'm calling it lawfare unraveling, but I'm really going beyond the question of lawfare. There have been several decisions coming out of the Supreme Court of the United States in recent days that have a dramatic impact, not just on things that are out there. They were going to impact you and I. Adam McLeod is somebody who I had the pleasure of meeting some years ago when I was working at the Alabama Policy Institute. He's formerly a professor of law down at Faulkner in Montgomery. He is now at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio. He's a senior scholar and former Thomas Edison Fellow at George Mason University. He's a visiting fellow in the James Madison Program at Princeton. He served as a law clerk to the Chief Justice Christopher Armstrong of Massachusetts Appeals Court. He's authored four books, dozens of scholarly articles, more than 100 essays and book reviews. Me personally, I feel like I get continuing legal ed credit every time I talk to him, and I'm proud to know him and to bring him on the show. Adam McLeod, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Listen, thanks for your time, and I know you're out in Texas. We miss you in Alabama, but thanks for making time for us today.
My pleasure.
Hey, listen, there's three cases in particular, and you can unpack others if we have time, absolutely, but three cases in particular that have drawn my attention in recent days. Supreme Court has come out with what is sometimes referred to as the Fisher decision, the immunity decision yesterday, and then a case that I think a lot of people don't realize the full impact of is this reversed what's called the Chevron defense. And I'm just going to ask you, could you unpack Chevron for us for a few minutes first?
Absolutely. This is arguably the most important decision the Supreme Court has handed down in the last two or three decades.
Wow.
Obviously, the decision last term to overturn Roe versus Wade and return the abortion issue to the states was a huge, important decision. It's one that many in the pro-life movement have been working for half a century. A great win for the rule of law and for the right to life. And so it was hugely important for those two particular issues. The Loper-Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo decision is just as important for nearly every issue that the United States government touches. So here's what the case is essentially about. Of course, your listeners will remember from their grade school civics that there are three branches of government, and the legislative branch makes and changes laws. The judicial branch then applies those laws in particular cases, and the executive branch is supposed to only execute the laws that the legislature makes. And they're supposed to stay, executive officials are supposed to stay within the boundaries of their powers that are laid down by the legislatures. It's the legislature that is accountable to the people, and therefore it's only the legislature that has the power to make law. The administrative agencies and various bureaucracies are supposed to stay within the boundaries of their legislative authority. Well, in a case decided in 1984, Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. The Supreme Court of the United States departed from that basic constitutional structure and said, well, when a federal agency is interpreting its own statutory grant of power, and it reaches what we call a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statutory grant, we're going to defer to the agency's understanding of its own power. And so, for example, if the Environmental Protection Agency says that waters of the United States, which is a term of art which covers navigable waters along the coasts and federal rivers, if the EPA says, well, that also includes a puddle in someone's backyard in Idaho.
Right.
This is a real case.
Yep.
And therefore, we can regulate their land under the Federal Clean Waters Act. Well, the federal courts are obligated to defer to that interpretation, even though it's clearly not within their statutory grant of power. And you can multiply examples. You can think of the Health and Human Services mandate a decade ago that celibate nuns have to pay for abortifacient drugs for their employees, you know, without any statutory warrant for that. So every overreach of the executive branch of the federal government over the last 40-something years has been essentially authorized by this decision in Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, and many people have been working very hard to get the court to overturn that decision as a way of reining in the excesses of the federal government. And that's what they did just a few days ago now in the Raimondo case.
So in cases we see like the ATF with bump stocks, they interpret things, or with Title IX with the Department of Education undoing women's sports and other things related to gender identification. All of these things are interpretations of law by an executive branch agency, and we can now call those into question based upon this new ruling, correct?
Absolutely. Every conservative and libertarian civil rights group in America should be gearing up to file lawsuits to challenge all of the various overreaches of the federal government over the last 40 years. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these, as the Code of Federal Regulations has just ballooned with creative, innovative, and frankly, in many cases, blatantly unlawful regulatory overreaches.
Well, I mean, this case right here, and I don't think we can downplay it, but this case, literally every school child, every farm, every business, every gun owner, I mean, you can just run down the gamut of citizens who are going to be potentially positively impacted by a single ruling that basically Chief Justice John Roberts, he wrote, agencies have no special competence in resolving statutory ambiguities. The courts do. What he's basically saying was stop interpreting. And that's huge.
It is. It re-empowers federal courts to do what they should have been doing for the last 40 years, which is exercise their own independent judgment as judges to read the statutes themselves and determine whether an agency is acting within its statutory authority. The Raimondo case itself is a great example of executive overreach. You've got a statute which was enacted to authorize the federal government to prevent foreign fisheries, consider Chinese or Russian fishing vessels that are within 200 miles of American shoreline, just, you know, pillaging our various fisheries. And the federal government, the Congress passed the statute which says that federal observers can go on board those foreign flagged vessels and observe to make sure they're complying with our laws, and the foreign vessel has to pay the salary of those federal observers. Well, the agency here determined that same statute could be used against American flagged fishing vessels. Imagine that. You're trying to make a living catching herring, out of the Atlantic Fleet in the United States. You're an American flying an American flag on your vessel. And now suddenly you've got to pay the salary of a federal employee to stand watch on your vessel and observe to make sure you're complying with federal law.
It's unreal.
So this is exactly the sort of overreach that unfortunately we've all become very accustomed to over the last 40 years. And this decision declares open season on these sorts of lawless actions.
Well, listen, knowing that we have limited time together, I need to go ahead and ask if we can move to the next one. Let's pick the Fisher case. So Fisher came out last Friday, I believe, and Fisher deals specifically with those who have been, criminally indicted on issues related to the January 6th so-called insurrection. Give us the quick rundown with about 3 minutes on Fisher's decision.
Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, enacted by Congress in response to the Enron scandals, and the purpose of the statute was to prevent major public corporations from destroying their records, which might be used as evidence in a fraud proceeding or a proceeding alleging violations of the Securities and Exchange Act.
Right.
That's the purpose of the statute, but there's a catch-all clause which also prohibits anyone from otherwise obstructing an official proceeding. So the federal government, the Department of Justice prosecuted this particular protester, Fisher, for being involved in the January 6th incidents and said that he was obstructing a proceeding. Well, it's very clear in context the statute's only meant to apply to corporations trying to destroy public records to get away with wrongdoing. It has nothing to do with the riot that took place at the Capitol on January 6th. Supreme Court very sensibly said that's right. The statute is confined to that particular context. It's about the destruction of physical evidence of corporate wrongdoing. And so this was an inappropriate use of the law here to prosecute this particular protester.
So aside from Fisher and a number of others, some of whom have already been convicted on this same novel interpretation of the statute, this also would technically impact the case against Donald Trump related to January 6th. Am I correct?
It could potentially, if a creative prosecutor wanted to bring charges against him under Sarbanes-Oxley. The more direct effect, of course, is going to come out of the decision which the court handed down yesterday in Trump versus United States.
Yeah.
There the court says, no, when we said all along that the president has immunity, we really meant it. And, immunity of the President of the United States is another important separation of powers constitutional principle. None of the three branches of government has the power to adjudicate the rights of any of the other three branches. If they did, then you would have tyranny. If Congress could adjudicate the rights of the president, or the president could adjudicate the rights of the justices of the Supreme Court, or then you have consolidation of power in one branch. So immunity for official actions is an important constitutional principle.
It is.
The court said the only question is whether his conduct was within his official actions, and there he's entitled to the presumption of innocence, just like everybody else.
Well, I tell you what I'd like to do right now is take a break and come back to that very situation, that very question, right after the break on the question of immunity. There's been some amazing rhetoric from the left, and there's even been some very interesting dissent by some of the more liberal members of the bench at the Supreme Court. So can you hang on during the break, Adam?
I will.
All right, we'll do it. Let's take a break right now. We'll hang on. We're with Professor of Law Adam McLeod from St. Mary's School of Law in San Antonio. We're going to unpack this a little further. Talking about lawfare is unraveling, yes it is, but the Supreme Court is also ruling in favor of the everyday citizen. Bill Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. Just, I mean, like making common sense like a superpower. All right, so we're back right now with Adam McLeod, who is a professor of law at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio. He's got a long career in jurisprudence and also in teaching the law. And I've had the pleasure of hearing him speak and doing a bit of work with him when I was at the Alabama Policy Institute. So, Professor, let's talk about the immunity case a little further. I mean, we're already seeing right now that just even today, Trump's legal team has already tried to extend the ruling in the immunity case that came out just yesterday to his conviction in the New York Alvin Bragg case, claiming that there was inadmissible evidence based upon time spent in his official acts. The bottom line is this. It's not saying that he can just lash out and be a president and take out somebody as an official act. I mean, there is still going to be line and scope of duties that has to be considered. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. The Constitution provides immunity for an executive official like a president when he's acting within his constitutional authority. So, you know, a classic example is if it's necessary to prosecute a war against a foreign aggressor, say we were attacked on American soil and a president decides it's necessary in a police action to defend us, people are going to die, unfortunately, in that circumstance. And so the president has to have some immunity from criminal prosecution for doing what's necessary and proper under the exercise of his war powers when those powers are conferred upon him under the Constitution. That's the basic core concept. Once you move away from that core, there are fuzzier questions, questions about whether the president is in fact acting within his lawful constitutional authority. And on those questions, the Supreme Court said the president is entitled to the presumption. And all that means, it's a legal term, which simply means that anyone who wants to argue he doesn't enjoy the immunity, a prosecutor in New York or a federal prosecutor, would bear the burden of proving that his actions in that particular case were not within the scope of his presidential duties. If they satisfy that burden, if in fact the president has gone out and, say, committed murder, obviously that's an act that's well outside the scope of his constitutional authority. He enjoys no immunity. But the prosecutor bears the burden of proving that that was a wrongful act outside of his lawful authority. That you don't just get to presume that the president has acted unlawfully just because he's the president. That's the bottom line.
Well, and with about 2.5 minutes left here, so Justice Sotomayor, who is obviously from the more liberal side of the Supreme Court bench, she had a pretty scathing dissent. I mean, she even said the president is now a king above the law. I felt like, to the extent you can comment on, I felt like this was rhetoric that goes beyond the normal dissent. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Justice Sotomayor is sometimes known for having rhetoric that's more fluff than substance. She has to be careful there, though. You might remember that President Obama ordered the assassination of an American citizen without due process of law. That's arguably a classic example of an action by a sitting president that well exceeds his constitutional authorities and is inherently unlawful. If suppose Donald Trump were reelected president in November, and he decided that he wanted to go after former President Obama for that action with a criminal prosecution, this ruling by the Supreme Court protects President Obama just as much as it protects former President Trump. So if we're going to have universal principles that are applied equally to everyone, we've got to apply the law the same to everyone. And that includes the constitutional immunities that are so essential to maintaining our constitutional republic.
Well, I knew you'd be able to unpack it well, and you certainly did. Adam McLeod, professor of law, St. Mary's University School of Law, thank you so much for your time today. And maybe we can call on you again because the Supreme Court, they've got some other big ones coming down the pike, it looks like.
Another big term coming in October. So, yeah, hopefully we'll speak soon.
Okay. All right, you take care. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Phil.
All right, listen, that was great analysis, and I love the fact that we've got a true scholar on call who can unpack these things for us. Adam McLeod, like I said, every time I felt like I sat and listened to him talk, I should get continuing legal education credit. But we're going to talk about this a little bit more when I get back, because this is truly lawfare is unraveling. What we're seeing right now is the cases that they're trying to bring against President Trump are beginning to just unravel before their very eyes, and Democrats are having a complete meltdown over it. And I'm loving every second. Y'all stay tuned. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We will be right, and we will be back. Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Phil Williams here live in the Right Side studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national covering down on all of the issues. And oh yeah, like the dude just said, solid conservative and just plain right. So welcome to hour number three. We're going to keep going with this lawfare unraveling. I'm going to unpack a little bit more for you and take it into the realm of politics. Before I do that, let me grab a few text messages. David in Huntsville says, Michelle Obama 2024, her real life story. He gives me a text to go watch, a link. I don't know, man. That could be. Maybe they could convince her to save the world. I think that her candidacy would excite a lot of the what I would call the uneducated base. But you have to ask yourself, what does she bring to the table? And I guess all they have is she brings personality and the Obama name. I think that'd be bad for him. I also don't think she wants it. I think she's had enough. I think she likes being in the limelight without being in the limelight, if you know what I'm saying. Randy from Madison says, all leftists are kin. They all have slick lizard skin DNA. Okay, thanks, Randy. Mike from Athens says, when Trump wins, can he pardon himself? From what? I guess it's so... There's an it depend. So first of all, it's an unanswerable question at the moment. It's never been done that I know of. With regards to the Alvin Bragg conviction in New York, that's a state case. So he can't pardon himself from a state conviction as president, is my understanding. Now, he could conceivably pardon himself for a federal conviction. I'm not going to be a bit surprised if Trump doesn't take office and immediately pardon everyone indicted on anything related to January 6th, which would blanket include himself. But he should, because this has been one of the grossest abuses of due process perhaps ever seen. Let's use that as a by the way, Mike, thanks for that question. Let me jump into that. I mean, that gives me a chance to go right to this story I've got from Fox that came out on July 1st yesterday. The headline is, what should the DOJ do about Trump's January 6th prosecution after Supreme Court's Fisher ruling? So last Friday, we unpacked it with Professor McLeod a minute ago. Last Friday, the Supreme Court in Fisher v. United States came out and ruled that the novel interpretation of the law that the Department of Justice has been using to try and indict and or convict all of these Jan 6ers, they can't do it that way. It was a novel interpretation of the law. And just to refresh real quickly, in case you missed the conversation we had with Professor McLeod last hour, Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, it literally was an act put in place to stop businesses from destroying documents that could have been used as evidence of their wrongdoings. So, like, for instance, somebody is running a Ponzi scheme out of their investment office, and the FEC is going to, excuse me, the FCC is going to come in and regulate security. I'm sorry, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they're going to come in and investigate. And somebody starts shredding documents. It's a violation of Sarbanes-Oxley. Why? Because the law says under Sarbanes-Oxley, you cannot just interfere with investigations by destroying documents, evidence, or tampering with witnesses. That's what it stood for. What did they do in the January 6th case? They interpreted a clause within there that related to interrupting or impeding federal proceedings as relating to the riot at the Capitol. Well, now they're all under Sarbanes-Oxley. No, they're not. You know why they did that? They did that because Sarbanes-Oxley has a 20-year potential 20-year sentencing attached to it, a 20-year maximum sentence. And they were using that to pressure people to take plea deals because they were facing long-term sentences. I mean, listen, January 6th shouldn't have happened the way it did. But January 6th is not what they've made it out to be. Don't tell me it was an insurrection. It wasn't. There's actually a federal definition in the U.S. Code for what an insurrection is, and this weren't that. Was it a riot? By some of them, yes. No one should have ever pushed a police officer, broken a window, shoved a door, knocked down a barricade. It shouldn't have happened. But when you sweep up every granny whose cell phone pinged a tower in relation to the Capitol and accuse them of insurrection, accuse them of violations of Sarbanes-Oxley of all things, well, Fisher v. United States said, no, by God, it doesn't. It doesn't work that way. So the DOJ has been wielding Sarbanes-Oxley now as a weapon against January 6th rioters. Over 300 people have been charged, including Trump, have been charged with this novel interpretation of the law. So now you have, out of 1,400 defendants, you have literally about a quarter of those that are now looking at having charges dropped and maybe their sentencing changed and their indictments and their even their plea deals withdrawn. You're going to have people going, praise God, I get to go before the court without having them holding a 20-year sentence over my head. Special Counsel Jack Smith has followed this Biden DOJ playbook just like to the letter. He indicted Trump related to January 6th. He indicted Trump on four felony counts. Four. Two of them are the Sarbanes-Oxley. Two of them. So half of the indictment for Trump on January 6th issues just went out the door. Bam, just like that. Lawfare is unraveling. It's a bad week to be a January 6th prosecutor on Jack Smith's team. So what's left on Jan 6th for Trump? But there's two charges left, and both of them are kind of frivolous. One of them is that somehow that he committed fraud against the United States, and they're using laws that basically are used against government contractors who inflate their bills. I mean, what? The other one is claiming that he somehow violated the voting rights of every American by attempting to alter election results. Well, if giving a speech is altering election results, then I want to know why we didn't have the same thing against Hillary Clinton. Why we didn't have the same thing against every other Democrat who claimed election fraud when they didn't like the way the outcome was. So all said and done, that Fisher case, there's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to be hopefully getting out of jail. Now, I really do believe that Trump is going to wind up pardoning people, and he should. But Attorney General Merrick Garland, oh man, he's doubling down. Merrick Garland issued a statement. I've got it right here. Same day as the decision came out. He says, quote, January 6th was an unprecedented attack on the cornerstone of our system of government, the peaceful transfer of power from one administration to the next. I'm disappointed by today's decision, which limits an important federal statute that the department has sought to use to ensure that those most responsible for the attack face appropriate consequences. What he's basically saying is, daggummit, we wanted to have 20-year sentences to put on these people. 1,400 defendants, he says, have been indicted by his department related to January 6th. I question how many of them now will see a change in their legal status. I got one article from The Hill, which is not always known for being conservative. It's not. But they published a piece by Jonathan Turley. Did a great job on this, as he always does. Jonathan Turley, a law professor, I believe, from Georgetown. He's constantly on Fox News, but he says the Supreme Court basically just downgraded the whole insurrection, so to speak, to trespassing. And it's true. This whole litmus test that the left has put on anybody who dares to speak in it. Are you a Jan 6 denier? Are you an insurrectionist sympathizer? Well, by golly, I am. And guess what? Supreme Court of the United States in a 6-3 decision says you guys are full of crap. Good on them. And I look forward to the next term of President Trump, where he issues an executive order on day one that pardons anybody indicted on the January 6th issue. I do. John C. from Madison just texted in. He says, do you think the J6 political prisoners might do a countersuit against the government? I don't know that they would, and I say that because every one of them was allowed advice of counsel, and they operated under what was then considered to be the existing state of law. But I think that this is going to give them, at the very least, an opportunity for redress on their criminal charges. Steve from Harvest says, would the Sarbanes-Oxley Act apply to the destruction of evidence by the January 6th committee? Well, now, there's a question for you, Steve. Man. You know, it's kind of interesting. Do you remember that whole thing? You bring this up, Steve. That whole thing where Tucker Carlson got hold of all the video from the surveillance cameras in the Capitol on January 6th, the stuff that we weren't allowed to see, the stuff that January 6th Commission, all those never-Trumpers, the January 6th Commission just didn't think that the American public, you know, needed to see that stuff. You know what I'm saying? Because it showed them being ushered in, having the doors open for them in some places. Remember the QAnon shaman being escorted around by a security guard? They're laughing and talking. There's fist bumps. You're like, what's going on right now? I thought this was like chaos. They also, by the way, showed the video when Ashley Babbitt, the only person actually killed on the January 6 events, was an unarmed civilian female who was shot by a security officer who panicked, and then he got an award as a hero. Yeah, ain't nothing like shooting an unarmed female. Get you a medal. Well, could they be brought up under Sarbanes-Oxley? I don't know if withholding it as part of an official proceeding is the same as obstructing the proceeding, but it does beg an interesting question. Lou Ann from Huntsville just says, the application of SOX, that's Sarbanes-Oxley, to the, quote, insurrection of January 6th reminds me of the people who cherry-pick scripture just to justify a narrow interpretation for personal benefit. You got to read the whole thing. Reading out of context is self-serving, and yet here we are almost 4 years later. Last week's Supreme Court actions thankfully give hope to the poor people that were railroaded purely for the crime of being at a rally. Great text, Lou Ann. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come right back and we'll jump into, I think it's going to be a three-dipper day, bud. I think we might actually get three dippers. Not that they weren't full. But oh yeah, we got plenty more where this came from. Y'all stay tuned. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We will be right. And oh yeah, we'll be back. We are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative, just plain right. A couple of quick text messages, a few actually. Bruce from Springville. Says, how about Sarbanes-Oxley can be used against the Attorney General? Well, I mean, listen, if things are operating in their official capacity, if he is doing something as a part of an investigation that he can't disclose things of or whatever, we can't expect there to ever be charges against him for that. Now, if he has violated, if he has destroyed evidence that should have been allowed to be used in a criminal proceeding, especially against these Jan Sixers and all that, then I would say, you know, potentially, absolutely. But Sarbanes-Oxley was originally designed to stop the impeding of federal investigations related to, you know, corporate acts. I don't know that it could apply in reverse by corporations or individuals suing the federal government. So I never having actually operated under issues related to Sarbanes-Oxley, I don't know the answer to your question fully, but, it, you know. We'll see. David from Taft, Tennessee says, does Sarbanes-Oxley apply to documents destroyed at the Penn Biden Center? Now, see, now you're in a different category. Now you just went to a place that is considered a quasi-corporate entity. Penn Biden Center is actually an extension of the University of Pennsylvania, Penn. But it's the Penn Biden Center, and it was set up, and I believe it was set up using independent funding, a lot of which came from China, by the way. So Sarbanes-Oxley, were they destroying documents? If they were, I don't know of it. I know we found classified documents there, and that was part of the investigation that was, you know, launched on President Biden himself, from which he was excused for being a kindly older gentleman with a failing memory. But Sarbanes-Oxley could apply to Penn Biden if they were destroying items that were designed or that were being investigated by a federal entity. Now, if there was no investigation, and they were just shredding stuff because never thinking they were trying to, you know, avert a criminal investigation, then no. But if they heard the feds were coming and they turned the shredder on, then yes, I think that that could apply. That's just Phil thinking from afar. But anyway, brand new texter who doesn't give us their name or where they're from is apparently just taking issue with the fact that I said something about Ashley Babbitt being shot. Says, tell us who you are and where you're from, unless you're scared. Says, quit making Ashley Babbitt out to be an innocent victim on January 6th when she and a mob were busting through secured doors and climbing through the broken window. Yeah. Yeah. Ashley Babbitt needed to be shot and killed, didn't they, you unnamed texter? Come on, man. Or woman. Give us your name. Tell us where you're from. Own it. But you're also just full of crap. Because was Ashley Babbitt wrong? I never said she wasn't. But was Ashley Babbitt deserving of being killed? She's dead. She's a family woman. She's a veteran. And she's dead. There's a whole lot of talk about, well, you know, there were like five police officers that died that day. No, there weren't. None of them. None. Ashley Babbitt is the only true death that day. An unarmed civilian who was literally in the act of climbing through a window, a place where she shouldn't have been, an act she shouldn't have been conducting. And I ask you, how many of the Antifa or the BLM rioters who rioted at the federal courthouse who rioted on government property? How many of the pro-Palestinian protesters who impede acts of government, how many code pinkers who impede actual governmental meetings and conferences and actual hearings? How many of those liberal protesters have ever been shot for protesting in places where they perhaps shouldn't have been, or at the very least impeding governmental action? I'm looking back and I'm saying, none. So, anonymous texter, if you're not scared, tell us who you are so we'll know that we have a liberal in the text mix. And I'm proud to have you. Glad to have you. Maybe you'll learn something by being on the show. Lou Ann from Huntsville says, you have to honor the intent of Congress when applying the law. And that is correct. We call that legislative intent. We do that under state law as well. If there is a question about the statute, the interpretation is allowed to be construed under the legislative intent of the time. And that is absolutely correct, Lou Ann. I think that's part of what happened in this this Fisher case, is they looked at the legislative intent. What was it intended for? And there is nothing that said it could be construed the way it had been. Handyman from Caddo, Alabama says, is there really any difference between destroying and withholding evidence? Wow. More than I could ask or answer when the music's already playing. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back.